this is Elliot Tiber. I'm the author of After Woodstock and Taking Woodstock. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom, my friends. Happy springtime to you. Happy everything. And when I think of springtime, I think of joy and flowers and pollen and allergies and mud. And it brings my mind to Woodstock. Now, Woodstock wasn't the most perfect thing in the world, but it has some wonderful things about it, and it would not have happened without the participation of our friend of the neighborhood here on Dave's Gone By, a man named Elliot Teichberg, later changed it to Tiber. He has been on this program before, talking about his first couple of books, Taking Woodstock, and then he wrote a sequel to that about called Palm Trees on the Hudson, about his earlier career, but now he's written the best and biggest book of all, really wonderful memoir that he has written called After Woodstock, all about the years post-1969 with life in Belgium, in New York, so many things that this man has lived more in 1 or 2 years than most of us do in 10. So there's so much more to talk about with Elliot Tiber, who is on the phone with us in the neighborhood. Shalom, Elliot.
Shalom, shalom. Thank you for having me here. It's very nice to talk to you again.
Very nice to talk to you, too. Now, you're not in New York. You're not in Belgium now. Are you living now in Florida, where all the Jews go?
I'm on Nemi Beach, Florida. It's called paradise.
Is it really? Isn't it humid and ugly?
It's not paradise for me. For me, paradise is Midtown Manhattan, Times Square, where I used to live. And I'm trying to get, hope this new book sells big enough so I could go back to New York. I don't like palm trees. I don't like sunshine.
So. You're a New York Jew. That's definitely. And plus, can you really get a good egg cream in Miami?
No, I've tried. Believe me, every other day I go to a place, they don't know what it is. I have to explain it. But they make it with Perrier instead of seltzer. You can't have an egg cream with Perrier.
No, certainly not. Now, there are so many different thoughts and ways of making the quote-unquote perfect egg cream. And since you are a connoisseur of these things,
Fox's You Bet chocolate syrup and New York seltzer.
Fox's You Bet chocolate syrup, New York seltzer, and, milk, yes?
And milk, of course.
Of course, the milk, yeah. So, but the thing is, and this bothered me about the You Bet, because I grew up with the Fox's You Bet. It's corn syrup now. It's really,
Well, I'm really an atheist, so kosher doesn't mean anything to me. But I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat pork or meat or any of that, and no chela, none of that stuff. I'm a vegetarian. I live on vegetables.
Huh. Do you miss meat?
What?
Do you miss?
No, not at all. I don't like killing animals. I have 2 Yorkies, and I don't want to kill any animals.
Okay, but let me ask you, I'm still harping on this egg cream thing, because corn syrup is not unkosher. I'm saying it's not made with cocoa. That's the thing I was trying to get across. That Fox's You Bet that I thought would be so old-fashioned and authentic and whatever, it's high-fructose corn syrup is the first ingredient.
I see. Well, I don't look at that. I just look at the taste. It's wonderful. You can't use Hershey's or other chocolate syrups. That's going to be Fox's.
I don't know. Try Nesquik. It's not bad. And that's got cocoa in there.
I did. I've tried them all. No, it's not the same.
It's got to be You Bet. All right. Well.
At least you know there's aggravation in the bottle. There's no aggravation.
Well, that concludes our conversation with Elliot Tiber. No, just kidding. We are just getting started with this man. We're rolling into it gently because he has had such a life and so many times since even the Woodstock. But let's put you there, and this is kind of where the book starts, and after Woodstock, you're living with your parents, the nebbishy, beaten-down father, the horrendous, awful, terrible mother, and you're in basically the worst hotel beyond the Bates Motel ever concocted. How the hell did you get out of there?
Well, it was, we were desperate. The bank was going to take the place over. I had it from 59 to 69 with my parents, and the bank across the street was going to come take it over. I was an artist, and I did paintings, so instead of payments on the mortgage, I gave oil paintings to the bank, and they
we know.
Yeah, well, a name we know now. Nobody knew it then.
Sure.
And so I called them and I said, listen, I have a permit for a festival here. So they took a helicopter and came there 10 minutes. White Lake did not have a helicopter landing pad. So my mother saw that helicopter come, and when she saw Mike Lang with his long hair and half naked, she said, it's Jesus has come to the motel to save us. First time she ever said the name Jesus. So Mike said, he had his lawyer with him. Let me see the permits. I showed him the permit, which is what I typed myself on my Underwood typewriter. There was no other permits. And it said I could have a festival. He said, how much you want for it? I said, $1 if you come here. So he gave me the dollar in cash. And within 20 minutes, limos started to arrive and other planes and equipment and trucks, about 100 trailer trucks came, and they parked at my grounds because there's no place to park there. And they started to build the Woodstock Festival. So everything changed instantly for me. We rented out every room in the place. Normally, he said, what do you get a room? I said, $8 if we could get it, and we can't get it because we don't have matching bedspreads. We don't have showers that work. We don't have toilet paper. It was really run down. And he said, I'll take it all. I'll pay you $700 a night for each room in advance.
Der Vault!
I mean, he gave me $25,000 in cash, and then my mother said, what about me? So he gave her $25,000 in cash, and we were sitting there in the bar. They took it over, but he's drinking. We're counting the money. Mother stuffed her money in her bra and my money in a mattress in the basement, and Woodstock began, and my life changed. I had no idea what I was getting into, and suddenly there were 1.5 million kids within hours arrived. They were, the Governor Rockefeller went on the radio and TV saying the New York Thruway was now closed to traffic. It was just all a parking lot that we were walking. And it was 1.5 million kids and hippies and flower children flooding our whole town. Everybody was doing, not heroin, but doing grass and weed and LSD and all of that, and colored pills of every kind. And I joined in. I was stoned out of my mind for those 3 days, well, 3 days, for 3 months. And suddenly, and there was music playing, and there was, they set up stages and all of that. And it was just a miracle, a major miracle. And so that was the way of getting out of the motel business.
Well, yes and no. I mean, after the concert, it was just a weekend. After the concert was over, okay, I'm sure people lingered for a week or two to keep soaking in the experience, but in 2 weeks it was abandoned again. You had a lot of cash.
I mean, there I was, and the winter went by. I was a decorator in New York, so I was back there, but I came up in June to help my parents do something. I told them, we don't need any money, just burn the place down, but they wouldn't listen. And then suddenly 9 black limos, stretch limos, pulled into the grounds, and families got out, using the word family in quotes, got out, and the sign on the place said, for sale, and with a question mark. So he said, I'd like to buy a nice place for me and my family. So I said, yeah, this is for sale. He said, well, and it opens up a shopping bag with money. It takes out. He said, how much? I made up a number, $187,000, which was like $1.8 million today. And I made up the number, and he takes out $187,000 in cash, puts it on the table there in the bar. Mother was getting pregnant at that moment again. And we sold the place. So I said, well, let me find, we don't even have a deed for the place. He said, doesn't matter, you don't need a deed, I trust you.
Mm, that is nice.
But that was it. So I'm getting in my car. He said, what's that car? My Cadillac. And he said, where are you going? I said, I'm leaving here. He said, you want to sell the car too? I said, sure. I paid $3,500 for it. So he said, here, it's $3,500. You took the car. I signed a piece of paper. And that was it. And I left Mother there walking on the highway counting money, delirious. And I got out of that goddamn motel.
Wow. Wow. We're talking, by the way, with Elliot Tiber. He's giving just a four-spice, the little appetizer, of the beginning of his new memoir for Square One Publishers. It's called After Woodstock. It's all the stuff that happened to him after Woodstock. And this miracle happened, this mafia miracle of this family that comes and takes this horrible thing off your hands and off the hands of your family. And you talk...
I said family.
Well, yes, family in quotes and then not so much in quotes. Of Italian origin, let's say.
Yes, they were Italian. I love Italian food.
And that money that they handed you, that becomes almost a big part of the first three quarters of the book. You're always saying...
I want to see if this money is real. So we went into town, he took the money to the bank, and they said, yes, it was all real. I wasn't sure.
And then you kept that in your bank, and you're referring to it constantly. I mean, as much as you despise, rightfully, your mother, she instilled in you some things about money and protecting it and making sure, you know, using it as little as possible and et cetera. Because throughout your stays in New York and other places, and California, you know, checking the nest egg. How much is there? I don't want to tap into that. Oh, I got to tap into it a little bit. It's this running theme throughout almost the whole book.
Yeah, well, none of the advice Mother gave me was right or made any sense. But I had the money now, and my life would change. I could do anything I want, and I always wanted to go to Hollywood and make movies. So I bought another car, and I drove cross country to Hollywood. I had two friends who lived there from Brooklyn yet, and so they said, come stay with us. And they had bought Marie Dressler, that old movie star from the 20s. They bought her mansion in Los Feliz, which is a section of Hollywood there.
Well, actually, you're now, it's a little unclear in the book, because was it really Marie Dressler's mansion, or did
yes,
they just...
Yes, it was. It was the editor said he's not sure. Well, the hell with the editor. It was Marie Dressler's house. Her picture was all over the place, and portraits of her with all her friends in every room. It was her home.
Oh, wow. Wow. I mean, people who don't... I mean, I wish I were Joe Franklin so that my audience would know who the hell Marie Dressler was. But if you see Tilly's Punctured Romance, the old Charlie Chaplin movie, she was part of that whole Max Singett team at that time.
She was a major movie star, Violent Days, and then later in the early talkies. And she was just a big, fat woman and wonderful actress. And so this was her mansion. And so I moved in there, and as far as I was concerned, I made it to Hollywood. I mean, that was already a big deal. But then I ran around, and I was trying to get a job in one of the studios, and all they offered me, they saw my background, was that I was an interior decorator. I could be a set decorator. Hello, that's not what I had in mind.
Wow.
So, you know, that aspect was over for me, and I went around with Woodstock and talking about Woodstock here and there, and everybody heard about it, but all they ever thought about it there was it was a drug orgy. Well, maybe it was. There was a lot more than that. There was music. Hello. 3 days of peace, love, and music, which is better than Libya and Tikrit and all these places where they're killing everybody.
Well, for sure. For sure. But what's kind of interesting is, and the thing occurred to me, is that when you made it to Europe and you went to Belgium and places like that, even the Europeans had a lower idea of what Woodstock was than Americans did.
Oh, yes, terrible. Well, I didn't last long in Hollywood. I went back to New York, and then three of them, I went back to the... I was into S&M and Leather Bars. I went to Leather Bars and the Mine Shaft, which is the biggest one, which incidentally was the basis of the film Cruising. William Friedkin's Cruising. He filmed it there.
Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you I think sex is a wonderful thing. I love sex. I wish we were having more of sex.
But you're a rabbi. Rabbis don't have sex.
Well, not in public anyway. Well, sometimes in public. On Purim, we might. You know, we do things with a jelly apple that you don't want to know about. But the question is, what do you get out of not just dressing up in leather? Why is that a thing for you? And even really being treated rather roughly in those things, smacked around and hurt, perhaps. What's the appeal?
Not perhaps, definitely. It was S&M, and I enjoyed it. I never did anything dangerous. It was mostly really like movies for me, but in real life. And
well, somebody punches you.
In the bar at 3 in the morning, stoned out of my mind, going home in the village where I lived, and there Georgian director, Andre or not. He introduced himself and what he was doing and who he was and me and so forth. And we went and it was my birthday weekend. We had a 3-day love affair that was beyond belief for me, because he was such an incredible person to be with. He wasn't physically any Arnold Schwarzenegger type, but he was just a terrific person, full of charm and wit and poetry and so forth. So we resonated together, and then he said, well, I have to go back to Belgium. He was in New York for 2 years on a grant studying theater and films and all of that, and his time was up. And Belgium to me was the Congo. I said, I'm coming with you. And sure, he left, and then I went to close up my apartment, and I went to what's that famous store for safari clothes, the biggest one, you know.
For safari clothes?
I went to that department store, and I bought safari outfits. I thought, I'm going to the Congo. I get on a plane in Sabina, and the stewardess says to me, why are you dressed in all those safari clothes? I said, are we going to the Congo? She said, no, we're going to Belgium, to Brussels. The Congo is someplace else. And they met me in Belgium, and it was a city. I couldn't believe it, with Texaco signs and McDonald's all over the place. And so I was beginning a new life in a new country, and they all spoke French and Flemish, and I didn't. So my Yiddish didn't help at all. And but that was where I found myself.
And you show up at his door or outside in the street, and he's shocked and thrilled to see you. And then, you know, suddenly it wasn't just going to be a weekend or a little while love affair.
I told him I'm coming there. He didn't believe me when I called from the airport in Brussels. I told him where I am. He was in shock. And he had a lover, and I didn't know that. The lover lived 3 blocks away, and I found out. We went to his apartment. There was one change of clothes hanging and one coffee pot. I said, you live like this? And so he explained he had a lover, but he was going to drop his lover of 10 years and to go with me. And so we fixed up the apartment, and we began life as a couple.
And not just as a romantic couple, but in some cases as a working couple. And then for TV.
I had to do something. I didn't need any money, but Andre was a director at the national television station. So he brought me in to introduce me to whoever, his companions, his boss. And I told the boss about Woodstock, and he was, Andre said, sure, about Woodstock. To them in Europe, Woodstock was a joy orgy, nothing worthwhile. But I told his director of the TV, and he was in stitches in a riot. I'm a funny man. And so then he said, what do you want to do here? Do anything. I said, I'd like my own TV show. And he said, you speak French? He said, no, but you put, cue cards for me. And Andre thought I was mad, but Andre, they gave him right away to direct my TV show. And it was called Sketch Up, which I named because it was like ketchup. I didn't know any French. And it was a bunch of sketches, like Saturday Night Live, that kind of thing, which is what I knew. And I decided I wrote a part to the lead character of a big guy with a beard and who didn't speak French and who was from Woodstock. And so they said, who could play that part? I raised my hand. So I started my own series. Series was a hit. The first thing of the season was the front page of all the newspapers of major new hit for Belgium. And it was the official entry into the Montreux Television Festival. We came in second. Julie Andrews came in first. Who ever heard of her?
Julie Andrews.
An unknown.
Too goyish.
Second year, we came in second. There was a British group that won the first prize, Monty Python. Who ever heard of that?
So, and you did, two more of those, did you, over the years? Did you, two more episodes of SketchUp?
We did three seasons of it. That's the third season was a collapse of it all because I don't know why. Their taste changed. I don't know why.
When you say season, so it wasn't just one episode. You did actual...
I call it a season. It was a series, like three shows was the season.
Okay.
So the first season we did three shows, the second season again three shows. The third season seemed to fall apart. I don't know why. I can't explain what other people do. And
fine. But
that's all. They have no taste.
And you're living in Belgium now, and Andre is working for the theater and the TV at the same time. And you're doing the TV, and you're doing some other stuff too, some other writing.
I've started writing a book called High Street, Rouault, in English, and Andre adapted it into French because I didn't know any French, and was screaming because in 44, I guess, buses came. The Nazis had buses parked on the corner where I was living and took away all the Jews. She wasn't Jewish. Her husband was. And so I wrote a story. I made up this story that she's banging on the windows of the buses for her husband for years, looking for her husband to return. And he didn't. And it turns out that's exactly what happened. And she got mad because of it. And the book was an instant bestseller. Within a week after the book came out, it was on all the bestseller lists. I got a call from a movie company. They wanted to make a movie out of it. And I always wanted to make movies. This was my first real offer for a movie. I used to talk about it, but no one ever did anything. And so we made the movie High Street. We got Annie Cordy, who was like the Cara Burnett of French-speaking Europe. We were in Paris for a weekend, and there was a American show.
What?
American musical she was starring in. How I forget, terrible. And I said, let's go see it. If you don't understand French, it doesn't matter. I know the show by heart.
Oh, what was it? Hello, Dolly? Was that the one?
Hello, Dolly. Hello, yeah. Dolly, right. And the title was Hello, Dolly. Not Au revoir, Dolly, or Shalom, Dolly. Hello, Dolly. So we went to see it. And I said, I want to talk to her backstage to be in that film, High Street. He said, you can't just talk to her. You can't just go there. It's like trying to see Barbara Streisand. I said, I know Barbara Streisand. I'm not worried. And I did. So we went backstage, and I introduced myself. She spoke to me because I said, I'm here from Hollywood with a script for a movie. I lied. I wasn't there from Hollywood. And I gave her the script in English. In the morning, she called to meet her hotel for coffee. Andre was in shock. He got all dressed up. I was in my leather. We go to a coffee shop there, and she's with her husband, who's her impresario, to speak a word of English. And she said, look, I read the script. My husband can't read it because he doesn't read French, but I told him what the story is. I want to play this part. All my life, everybody just gives me musical comedies. I want to do a dramatic role. And she takes out a blank sheet of paper, signs her name. She said, you're not just here from Hollywood. You don't have money for the movie. You don't have a producer. You don't have anything. Gurnished. She said, blemish, gurnished means nothing. And she said, but with this paper, you'll get what you want. And Andre was in shock. We called a producer friend of ours. We showed him the paper. He said, I'll make the movie. Made copies of that paper. And, of course, he got the money instantly because of Annie Cordy. And that's how we got that movie made.
Well, actually, the producer, he funded the movie, but it was Andre Arnott, your friend and lover, who directed the movie.
Directed the movie, and I wrote it. Andre had translated it to French, but Andre directed because he was the famous director. And they gave grants for movies to Belgians. I wasn't a Belgian. So they gave us a grant for 65% of the movie. The other 35% in Paris, private investors put up the cash instantly. And we were making a movie. And Mort Schumann, who I knew of, was performing there in Paris, and I wanted him to play me. I wanted John Voight to play me because I knew John. But John's wife was having a baby, Angelina Jolie, the first day of shooting, so he canceled. That's why I don't talk to Angelina Jolie, because she was born the day of our film.
Well, it's okay. John Voight doesn't talk to Angelina Jolie either, so there you go. As far as I know.
Lena, she has such health issues now.
Well,
So we got Mort Schumann to play the, because he spoke French, and to play the lead, my character in the movie, and so we got it. We got Mort Schumann in the movie.
The really interesting thing about After Woodstock is you had this horrible, miserable childhood and teen years. You know, over in the El Monaco Hotel with those parents and you know, essentially poverty and awfulness. And then there's a period of your life where you're just the luckiest person alive. Like, everything that you put your mind to, you have this, I don't know, this positive charm above your head. And it's like, we'll go talk to Annie Cordry backstage. Wouldn't it be nice if we could sell the American rights to this book, High Street, to a major publisher? And Andre's telling you, well, no, you can't just, how are you going to do that? And you say, well, I don't know, I'll go find Audrey Wood, you know, which you did.
Yes. Anyway, Andre and I get so excited about all of this that we decided, let's go back to New York. We have a movie, and we could open the movie in New York and have a career in movies in New York. So we went back to New York, and I did private screenings that I had no connections, no disease. distributors. I knew no one. It was very naive, but we had some money, so we rented cinemas and we did private screenings, and we didn't sell the film. Absolutely nobody was interested in the movie. And we opened it ourselves, and it was a failure, and so that was really very depressing. But we were still doing what we were doing, our writing and more stuff, and then we lived on 15 West 72nd Street. And in 1980, John Lennon was assassinated right outside the building on the corner. And we were there. It was just amazing. And we went to Central Park, where they had a memorial garden. They still have it there about him. And so that was part of us, too, at the moment. And
you know, you guys and your lover, now you were in New York, he's working, he's doing stuff at the Vineyard Theater, he's at Playwrights Horizons and things like that. I'm curious, you don't name names or mention it in the book, but he mentions a few different times when he was working on a play off-Broadway or bringing it to fruition, and then it would be taken away from him and somebody else would direct it on Broadway or in a more commercial off-Broadway setting, steal all his ideas.
But it was terrible. He was Belgian. We were not connected, and we had a big success off Broadway of a show. I forget now even the name of it, and because it was so painful. And what would happen is suddenly it was announced that the show was being produced on Broadway with another director. So that was really very impossible for us to deal with.
But you don't remember the name of the show or the people?
It's a famous play. I forget now.
Okay.
No, I forget. I'm sorry.
Because sometimes people leave out names.
I'm 80 years old and I forget stuff.
Sure. Oh, Mazel Tov, by the way. When did you turn 80?
80 this April 15, tax day.
So you will be turning 80 in a week and a half.
Yes.
Mazel.
Oh, yeah.
How do you feel, by the way? How is your health?
My health is excellent. I smoke like I always did, 3 packs a day. I have no problems with my health. All my checkups are fine.
How's your weight?
My weight is fine. I'm slender for all of these years.
Well, from the smoking, of course, you know.
Well, I've been slender all these past years. I don't eat much. I eat vegetables.
Right.
I eat a lot of cakes and cookies anyway, but I'm diabetic. It doesn't show up. My health seems to be perfect, so.
Now, people, and I ask this question also because people kind of assume that because you and Andre were a gay couple, you were lovers, and you were going to the mineshaft, both of you were going to all these clubs where people were doing pretty wild, very, very unsafe things. You both quite literally dodged a bullet in a way, and yet people assume that Andre died of AIDS, which he really didn't.
No, he died of hepatitis B, which he got. I still think he died of AIDS, but officially it was hepatitis B. The mineshaft where we went was a sex club, and the thing is, I was never into fucking. So I didn't need condoms or all of that stuff. I was into S&M, which is really physically slapping around and whipping.
But there's blood involved. That's the most dangerous thing, isn't there? Or maybe not.
What's dangerous?
Blood.
Slapping around? No. Why is it dangerous?
Well, if you bleed. No?
Bleed. No, I was very careful about that.
Okay.
Andre, on the other hand, met somebody there. We were brothers for the last 10 years of our life. We were together 27 years. The beginning was sex. Afterwards, it stopped, and I fooled around with whoever I wanted, and he met a guy. He liked big and fat, and I was no longer big and fat. So I'm somebody big and fat. And I warned him, do not fuck. Do not have intercourse. Please, never mind condoms. I don't trust them. They break, blah, blah. He didn't listen, and he was screwed, and he caught AIDS from this guy, and he died. And
so you are using the A words. I didn't remember seeing that in the book, because you're
AIDS.
Specific
as
hepatitis B, but you're saying it was...
But it was AIDS. Hepatitis B and AIDS, it was all the same.
But he didn't have the sarcomas. He didn't have the lesions and things like that.
No, he didn't have any of that.
Isn't that AIDS?
Yes, I guess it is.
So,
I'm not a doctor.
Well, neither am I. I'm just wondering. I'm just, you know.
Everybody we knew was catching AIDS. We went to 40 funerals. But I didn't catch anything because I didn't do any intercourse. So I guess I was safe. Or maybe my system. Some people don't get it. I didn't. I was lucky.
You were lucky. Even when you first went to California and the people you stayed with, one of them died of AIDS.
Yeah,
right?
He died. Jerry, my friend who owned the house, he was doing all kind of drugs and sex and sex and sex.
you involved in ACT UP and things like that, and the early stages of being political about it and social? Or were you just too caught up?
The ACT UP movement started in New York. I forget his name. I was friends with him, so I joined in, and I was helping, making phone calls and doing speeches and trying to convince people to be careful. But it was a party time in New York, and people weren't listening, and they were dropping like flies. And unfortunately, just now it's history, but then it was happening while you were there, and it changed everything.
What I'm kind of curious about is, you lived platonically with Andre for 10 years, and I would figure, since you already knew each other, etc., why was it not physical, since, you were had been together, you weren't going to leave each other?
It weighed up, it came slim, and he hated slim. He
I know, but...
heavy.
But still, I mean, you would go to clubs and stoop strangers that you weren't particularly attracted to, per se. And yet, here's a person right there, a knight, you're horny, you never got together. I don't quite understand that.
He was busy with someone else. He met this guy, Terry, and he slept over at his house a lot, and they were having sex all the time. Jerry was married. He left his wife for Andre. He was married with children, and he left them... just didn't make any sense to me. He was a nice guy. I didn't find him attractive in any way, shape, or form. But that's what Andre decided he wanted. Listen, Andre had a few problems to lie in.
Well, I mean, he was also a drinker, and that killed his liver, too. But can I ask, do you regret that decade? Obviously you wouldn't regret the first love affair, the blah, and living in Belgium and all that, but do you regret giving such a portion of your life to a non-romantic, an out-of-love relationship?
I didn't give anything. We shared life. We shared the same interests. We were tender with each other. We loved each other. We were like brothers eventually. And I wasn't giving him anything. I was sharing life with him. And I was very rich for that. I don't regret any of it.
That's lovely.
I regret that he's not here to share old age with me.
True. True. By the way, you when you were living in New York, you were living in a very cool apartment building that was made for actors and people in the performing arts. And it was called the Manhattan Plaza. It's still there.
Plaza in Times Square, yes. We got an apartment there. Our agent, Audrey Wood, who's a famous agent, she represented Tennessee Williams. That's how we got in touch with Tennessee Williams. And Truman Capote, and she decided to represent that she saw High Street at a screening. And she got us into, she was on the board of that building, got us in. We applied. It was a waiting list of 20 years. So we got, it was subsidized apartments. We had a beautiful, beautiful apartment. But after Andre died, I couldn't face it, so I moved out. I shouldn't have, because I would still be able to live there.
Right.
I just moved out. I couldn't stand to be there anymore without Andre, all his things around. I just left everything. I donated to charity.
You couldn't. This I understand. But while you were living there, I mean, Tennessee Williams was living there, was he?
Yeah, Tennessee was living there, so was Colleen Dewhurst.
Right.
We met, and we were friends with them in Tennessee, and...
So tell us some anecdotes, some memories of Tennessee Williams.
Well, with Tennessee, he was stoned and drunk with us at Truman Capote, so we were friends and neighbors, and we had sexual stuff going on. Not Andre, he didn't want to participate. But we had sexual stuff going on there between us, and parties, and a lot of fun. Tennessee was brilliant. I always admired his work. He was absolutely brilliant. And
What was he like in that later period? Because he had peaked with those plays in the 1950s, and then people see it as just this downhill sort of slide. And was he depressed? Was he upset that he wasn't considered who he was anymore? Or is that not the whole story? Was he basically felt lucky and happy that he had such success to begin with?
He never talked about his work. I tried to because I was interested in it, but mostly he was drinking and doing pills, and so was Truman. And that was what we did. We drank and did pills, and we partied and had a lot of fun. We went to clubs, and everybody came over to the table because it's Tennessee. So he asked me to buffer for him a little bit to keep people away. He was, being annoyed. He'd rather just sit and talk with us. And there was no intellectual relationship there at all. Nothing, unfortunately. I would have liked that. I even said to him, I think you and I ought to write a play together. He hear me. Or
didn't want to hear you or whatever. Now, the other side of the coin, however, is, as you mentioned, Colleen Dewhurst, who was obviously as wonderful a person as she was an actress.
Yeah, so Colleen was a lovely woman and friendly and full of humor and fun. And we talked about doing some kind of project together up at Yale where Andre taught for a while. And that's where we met Meryl Streep. She was in one of his workshops there. We got to be friendly. Her daughter, Mamie Gummer, was in my movie, Taken Woodstock. So at the red carpet for the movie, Taken Woodstock, there was Meryl, and we hugged and we talked for about a half hour. We were talking about how she remembered Andre well, and she didn't know he died. And I told her all of that, and so that was my connection with Meryl Streep, who's a lovely, sweet woman, really terrific and wonderful sense of humor.
Who are some other celebrities and people that we would know that you have nice, delightful things to say about, or memories, or funny anecdotes about?
My God.
Not necessarily from your apartment, but from just working with Andre and being at the theater every night and things like that.
Oh, yeah, well, there was, who do we meet that you would know, the, who starred in one of his plays? Oh, my mind is gone. My mind is gone.
Well, what was, Barrymore, the guy who played, who am I thinking? My Jean, no, well, that was Dewhurst. Who else? Oh, well, if anybody comes to you.
Yeah, okay, I'm trying to think, of who. I mean, everybody was there.
And can I ask also, you, one of the things that kept yourself going while you were in New York again, I mean, Andre had all the directing assignments, but you worked as a teacher for many, many years. You got to teach a course on humor. What was your main thrust? How you teach comedy?
Yeah, at the New School University, I taught for 12 years. They called me in for one class, and it turned out it was so packed and full, I guess because my Woodstock name, so they gave me three classes, which was always full, and it turned out I was teaching 12 years absurd twisted comedy. I was teaching how to take real life and twist the facts and information around and fictionalize it to make it comedy, and it worked. And a lot of my students had nice successes off Broadway. A couple had films. I can't remember their names. Did some film because of the course. So I taught there for 12 years. And Andre taught there just one semester. He didn't like teaching anymore. And but I did. I taught it for a long time. And I was trying to get back to New York recently, and everybody that was head of there, of the writing department, all that, they're all dead, and the new woman there, I forgot her name, she's 33, I had to explain to her who I was and all of that, and she said, well, we're full up, and we have serious writers who teach at the new school. I said, serious writers? What am I, chopped liver?
Yeah, you're on your third book already. You wrote a screenplay that got produced. You wrote a play. Well, we didn't even talk about that, The Music Keepers, that got done off-Broadway.
Very famous writers, more famous than
well, yeah.
Teaching there, and so she didn't have any teaching for me. And I was got friendly with Annette Insdorf, who's chair of the writing department from the university, and she just wrote me an email yesterday. She read after Woodstock, found it delightful and wonderful, and I asked her about teaching there. She said she'll make inquiries, although they are full up, and they have famous writers from all over the world want to teach at Columbia.
Well, sure.
And so they have that, a long list of famous writers who want to teach there.
But wait a minute, if you... let's say got an adjunct job teaching English or writing again at one of these places, that won't be enough for you to move back to New York. You couldn't live on that.
No, but I'm resourceful and I have money saved. I'm not starving.
Thank God.
I have lots of money saved and I'm trying to move back to New York. I would like to have some connection with something there to keep me going, and the teaching would be one of them. But there are other things. I'm investigating those possibilities now.
What about teaching in Florida?
I don't like Florida. I don't want to stay here.
All right. Well, what about a little bit more north, like Georgia? There's a Jew or two there.
New York City is about as north as I want. Okay. San Francisco, those are the two cities that I like.
The most expensive cities, of course. Go figure. Go figure. So, now that you've written...
Maybe there's a rich daddy listening to this show of yours, and he's going to call you how to reach me. who wants to take care of me in New York, I'll say, fine, do it.
Take well, if they want to reach you, you have a website where people can go and order your books and learn more about you?
AikenWoodstock.com or ElliotTiger.com, and you see all of that. My book is on Amazon. It's in all the Barnes & Noble stores, if there are any of those left. Bookstores all over the country have it. And the After Woodstock is really a treasure for me because it's what happened to me in my life after the festival, and all of some of the things I've been telling you about. And it's a funny book, but it has some serious moments in it. And I've gotten rave reviews from Publishers Weekly, and Kirkus reviews recently came out with saying it's brilliantly written and funny and touching and moving. It's as if I wrote the reviews. I can't say as if my mother wrote the reviews because she hated my writing.
Well, she hated everything about everything, really. You shouldn't even take it personal anymore.
I showed her my first Woodstock book, which I wrote, which was, I forget the name now, that I published myself because I couldn't get anybody interested. I showed her the book, and she says, Verschmutz. Schmutz is Yiddish for dirty. Verschmutz.
You reminded me. The one last question I wanted to ask Elliot Tiber before we let you go, but I forgot the whole Schmutz thing. You naughty boy, even naughtier almost than going to the clubs in the mineshaft, you and Andre were dubbing porno movies, but weird ones.
Well, we got a call to dub some movies, and they were softcore, I called them borecore. And it was this Canadian woman who heard about us in Paris, so she called and hired us, and we were writing the dubbing dialogue and doing the dubbing. We hired friends from big American organization, the wives of them,
the Daughters of the American Revolution? No.
American Women's Club,
something like that, yeah.
And I got about 18 of these women who thought it would be wonderful to do porno. In fact, it was just bore. And they were sitting there doing all of this stuff. And
because you had these basic normal housewifey women, and suddenly you've got them, they're not doing anything. They're just doing sound, the audio tracks, and they're moaning. I just find that really funny.
Making noises and all of that, and looking at these stupid pictures in the film. And one of the women was the wife of the head of NATO, and he came in to pick her up, and he saw what we were doing. And he yanked her from the movie. Yanked her.
At least he wasn't yanking something else, I'll tell you. Oh, my God, that's funny. That's funny. But, hey, it paid the bills for a while, you know?
Yes, it did. Well, we got paid very well. We did around 74 films, and they were just all boring and stupid, but we did them, and they were for Canadian market, so our names, we never used our real names with it. It was just terrible, but they paid very well, and we were very fast, and we did the casting.
I think what's funny is you also write in the book that if there were only parts of a movie, they would Frankensteinianly mash them together. So,
but a lot of the heavy porno stuff was not allowed in New York screens, so what they did is they took those pieces out where we were dubbing them, and then they put them back in, and then they went to their foreign markets where they showed these movies. These were movies for the raincoat crowd.
Right, well, sure. Oh, my God. Well, I mean, it's funny, you know, as weird and crazy and sad, that sounds like one of the more fun times of your life in an interesting way. I bet it was.
It was a lot of fun to do it. We laughed. We couldn't take it seriously.
Of course.
It was paying good money. And we enjoyed doing it. That's what we didn't broadcast what we were doing. It was nothing to be, you know, proud about. It wasn't any major accomplishment. But it enabled us to do other things, too. And we were, I've never been satisfied to just sit still. I like to do new adventurous things. Except for the time, I wouldn't do it now. But at the time, it was very adventurous for us to do that.
And one thing I want to ask about is that, I don't know if this is good for you or bad, but if people go on YouTube, somebody posted the movie High Street, Rue Haute. It is not subtitled. I mean, I think if you speak French or Belgian, you'll understand it for English.
The version that's available here is subtitled. And then there's another version that's dubbed. And I know it's they didn't inquire from us. I don't know how they got it. And you can't find anybody to sue. They posted the movie all over Twitter and YouTube, and people downloaded it on Netflix. I don't know where they got it from. We don't get a dime from that, but that's what they do.
But you can't get the movie with subtitles from Netflix and places like that if people want to see it. Yes? It's been released.
If they could go to Netflix and they could get it, and film stores have copies of it, and Netflix has the copies of Taken Woodstock, which is a lot of fun to see. It's a good movie.
Yeah, and by the way, Ang Lee.
The speeches who did the movie, they went out of business, so they're not promoting it.
Oh.
They went out of business a few years ago, and so they don't promote it. They just, everybody involved just disappeared.
Well. But, and by the way, we should mention that the book, After Woodstock, which is from Square One Publishers, it has a foreword by Ang Lee, who really turned your life around when, you know, you just gave him the book, and he said, okay, I'm going to make this movie. And that
Ang Lee made, when I gave him the book, I met him by accident on a TV talk show in San Francisco, and I gave him the book. I said, maybe you'll make a movie out of this book. And then 2 months later, he called. He said, come to a meeting in New York, and I met all the big shots at Focus Features. And they're discussing the book and photographs all over the walls of me, my family, my house in Brooklyn, the motel, all of that. And they said, we want to make a movie. And they did a major movie out of it. And I got to be friendly with Ang Lee, who's a brilliant genius of the director, with a wonderful sense of humor. He got it. And he made this incredible movie. Unfortunately, I told you, Focus.
My Agabiz, yeah.
Fell apart, and they didn't promote it. They didn't do anything with it, so it had just a limited run.
But it's widely available. I mean, that's a movie that anybody can easily...
get it on Netflix, so they could buy it, and wherever they buy films, there are copies available. A lot of them are illegal, but what can do? Nothing I can do about that.
Well, last question for Elliot Diber. What do you see after Woodstock in movie terms? Do you see that being movieable?
I'm trying to get a movie deal for After Woodstock. I sent a copy to Robert De Niro. Ooh. I sent a copy to Brad Pitt. I want Brad Pitt to play me.
Of course you would.
Right? You know, yeah. Like on radio, they can't see what I look like, but I look just like Brad Pitt.
But wait a minute, because you lost all the weight, but back when this is all happening, you went up to like 200 and something pounds, so I don't know. Philip Seymour Hoffman, he's gone. He would have been possibly.
Yeah, oh, he was brilliant. I was so sorry. I met him once in a village. We lived in the village, so at least lived at the same time. I met him, and we had some coffee and talked. I was so sad to see that he killed himself. Terrible.
But I love, you know, considering all that you've been through, up and down, huge peaks and valleys, you have this optimistic way about you, this forward-thinking way, and a way of like, what's the next thing? What's something new and creative?
I'm trying to get a movie deal, Phil, after Woodstock. I would love to have a movie made of this, and I'm sending it out, and my agents are sending it out, and that's what I'm hoping. It's a new book. It's only out a month. It's sold out in Amazon right away, and a big bestseller in bookstores across the country. So I'm hoping that someone wants to make a movie out of that.
Well, I hope that for you, too, because I have to say, I've read the book cover to cover. It is really, really good. I was thrilled to read it. And, you know, he's told some of the stories in the book, but you really have to read it, as I did, cover to cover, to get the full sense of it and the real stories and the relationship between him and his family and him and Andre and you and your sister. That's a whole wonderful other thing. She's sort of the counterbalance to your mom. Because your sister sounds like a really wonderful lady.
Yes, she is. She's still alive. She's 2 years younger than me. She lives in Jersey. We talk every day for hours, and she's a wonderful person. And she's very shy. I told her if I get a movie deal, I want her to play my mother. She said, never, never, never.
Don't put it to
that. She loved my mother for some reason and liked her cooking, too. Well,
whoa. Well, not the way that chillin' that you described in the other book. Ugh.
Good morning.
I need to have an egg cream after thinking of your mother's chulent. Definitely. Right. So let's go get ourselves some egg creams. Let's all make sure that you go to takingwoodstock.com, get the book, check out Square One Publishers for that. And we thank you once again, Elliot Teichberg, for being with us in the neighborhood, wishing you health and many more good things in a movie.
Thank you very much. You're very kind, very generous. I appreciate it.
Shalom to you.